Good morning, followers of the Great Way. The origins of suffering, I teach, and the way out of suffering. And that was where, of course, the man started. And what better place than that for us to start? And if it be suffering, there's no greater suffering in the world than social suffering when one recalls the millions of men, women and children slaughtered for a start in two world wars and the many genocides that continue to cause so much grief. So part one of my talk will be about the origins of suffering, and particularly social suffering, because you can't separate personal suffering from social suffering, as I shall try to demonstrate. And the second part of the talk will be about the way out of suffering towards what I've called a radical culture of awakening for all people. Just two little technical matters. If the transmission to your ears becomes a bit faulty anywhere, just raise your hands and wiggle your hand around and we'll see what's gone wrong. Because my management of the hand mic is not so good, but I can't bear to sit down being a Welshman and given to this kind of oratory. The other point is that the proceedings of this conference, all the papers will be published, but also they will appear on the Western Chan Fellowship website for your ready inquiry. Because my talk, and I suspect David's too, will be fairly closely argued. Okay. Now, many of us here have vowed umpteen times, we Mahayana Buddhists, I vow to liberate all beings. Now, I think we can extend that a little Dharma-wise and say, I vow to free all beings from delusion. Seems it's originally meant, the Bodhisattva vow. And now I think we can carry that just a little further and say, I vow to deliver all beings from delusion, whether personal or social. I don't see how we can omit the reference to social as well, in view of what I've said about the grief caused to humankind, as I should try to explain, by social delusion. And I should always remind you, of course, that there is really, in the long run, in terms of one's practice, there is no difference between personal and social delusion. Now, useful to define before we start what I mean by delusion. I see it as the customarily unconscious state of mind where we believe that we can fill our underlying sense of lack, as David calls it, and escape from our gnawing sense of root insecurity and maintain a strong sense of being a separate and secure self. And to that end, typically, humans pursue every imaginable kind of what I would call evasion. And the evasion never in the long run brings ease and satisfaction. And that frustration which this failure creates, creates grief and sadness and rage and anger and frustration. And it was those feelings that the Buddha called dukkha, very badly translated as suffering, which gets all mixed up with pain. And that frustration causes individuals to do quite a bit of harm, driven harm to people close to them and to themselves, but cumulatively and collectively has made of our human history what Hegel called a butcher's block. Twenty or 30 years ago, when socially engaged Buddhism first emerged, we suffered quite a bit of hostility from the Buddhist community at large, certainly in this country. And we were warned, if you got involved in all this kind of stuff, we would deepen our delusion and delude others. And then we should sit on our cushions quietly and wait for enlightenment to dawn. And if it took several lifetimes, well, so much the worse for us. And the response was that from David Brandon, well, that's not Mahayana Buddhism, that's Manyana Buddhism. And for Robert Aitken Roshi, he eloquently explained that our spiritual maturity comes through our skillful and positive handling and approach precisely to all these delusive discomfitures which litter our lives. You know, that is ultimately the way, as proclaimed, in fact, in all Buddhist traditions. We are further told that there isn't no such thing as society. This is before Mrs. Thatcher made her memorable remark. There is no such thing as society. There are only men and women and their families. What I call the atomic theory of society. And therefore, it is sufficient for each of us to be kind and do some good to our circle around us. These ripples, over time, will spread wider and wider. And enough people have then become enlightened to create Sukhavati, the great utopia, to which we responded. Very good. Important thing to do. Part of our practice. But these ripples will never undermine the power, the delusive and magnetic power of what I shall explain as ideology and the institutions associated with it. And it is quite elementary social theory, hardly rocket science, to appreciate that men and women together in societies develop shared beliefs and behaviors and the institutions which arise from these, and that these beliefs and behaviors are bigger than any individual, and they begin to have a kind of power of their own. I have many capitalist friends, some of my other friends might find odd, and we've often discussed this. And one of them frankly pointed out, he said, look, I have only a certain amount of leeway, you know. If I undertake some of the things I like to do for others, I might cut my profit. And if the profit of the company falls, our ability to compete with others will lessen, and the shareholders will understandably complain, particularly if they've got to run pension funds. So there are these limits on our individual kindness. Most of us here are probably, or many of us are in employments which we prefer not to be if we had a chance. Now, I should explain, I think, what I mean by institutional delusion. For institutional or social delusion, I've coined the term ideology, which I use in a particular way. I've defined it as a more or less explicit set of social beliefs and assumptions which support and inflame personal delusion. Yeah? Is that all right? An ideology claims to present an objective view of reality. Like the dominant ideology at the moment is free market capitalism, preferably unrestrained. And the weird belief, therefore, that profit is the ultimate value. Because if the thing works well, and we see it doesn't, it works the way it's supposed to work, somehow the search for profit, and the more unlimited and uncontrolled the better, will increase human happiness and well-being for all. It's beginning to dawn on us now how mad, like all ideologies, this is. Orwell defined ideology beautifully. He called it the subjective contamination of reality. The subjective contamination of reality. In other words, how we are is what we see. And he said further that in its wilder shores, as evinced by examples ranging from Stalin's megalomania to George Bush is equally mad War of the Worlds notions, it then becomes something worse and more absurd. It becomes what he called masturbatory fantasy. Yeah, it's very profound, masturbatory fantasy. Now, there are two kinds of ideology. There's hard ideology, of which examples are religious fundamentalism and the kind of ideology that socialism degenerated into, called communism. And then on the other hand, there's the most powerful historical of all ideologies, what I call the soft ideology, which is the theology of free market capitalism and the popular religion of consumerism, which it sustains and inflames. And the alternative to ideology, something we do need, is what I call theory, open theory, social wisdom. We need guiding ideas, but we need guiding ideas which are not driven by the fear and self-need created by the typical human condition. And our great Cockney mystic, William Blake, has written beautifully about this kind of social wisdom. The need to clean the windows of perception, fogged up by our delusion. Because when we can see clearly through these windows and see how things are and accept how things are, we can then behave wisely and with clarity and really get somewhere to creating a better world. We need, he said, to strike off the mind-forged manacles. Beautifully precise, that. The mind-forged manacles. The manacles we ourselves have forged with our own hands. So we need that. But returning to ideology, I'd like to give you some feeling of its magnetic power. An ideology nourishes the hungry and fragile sense of self with feelings of righteousness and certainty. That self cast as it is upon this great frightening ocean of impermanence and insubstantiality. So it might be the inevitability of the proletarian revolution, or it might be, alternatively, the inevitability of bringing wealth and happiness to all through increasing production, ignoring the fact that we live on a finite planet. Above all, ideology gives meaning to life. Again, something the search itself is searching for desperately. And it also brings belongingness. This great movement of ours, our great nation, so the poor little self can then identify with something bigger and feels much better as they lustily sing God Save the Queen or the Red Flag or whatever you like. Or even if it's limited to buying the imitation Gucci handbag. Nice little bit of belonging, brand belonging. And the whole thing is hyped up still further. We belong. What about them out there? Those people who are different. What about scroungers and towel heads and terrorists? So we can project our fears and irritations onto others. And the mass media specialize in this rancorous kind of populism. And so do certain politicians. Because they know that that's what sells papers and buys votes. Because the average person carries around with them a lot of rancor. You know, why is it so? Why me? Which comes ultimately, as we all know, we've done a bit of sitting, from fear. You remember the mass media represents, as David has pointed out, the third of the three fires, which is total and universal pig ignorance of our human situation. And fourthly, ideology creates ideal opportunities for individuals and ruthless groups to power up their own ego and make a mark on the world. They used to be called heroes. Now the media, at work again, calls them celebrities. And a poor little self, feeling very inadequate, as most of us do on and off, can have a celebrity to identify with, finding it in such singular journals that you see in my dentist waiting room, like Hello magazine. And ideology thus powers up what Buddha called the fires of hatred and aggressiveness and of greed and acquisitiveness. There's the acquisitiveness that drives our society, driven by advertising and limitless credit. The acquisitiveness of nations and transnational corporations to steal the land and resources of other peoples and of nature herself. The acquisitiveness which leads companies to acquire the labor, as Marx explained, of the employees in an unjust way in order to fatten themselves, which acquisitiveness has created in the UK the most socially unequal society since the 1890s, which is saying quite a lot. And that acquisitiveness goes hand in hand with aggressive power over others, greedy exploitation of others, even the exploitation of their bodies in various ways. Okay, we're doing all right. That's part one. We're doing okay. Because what we're doing together, we're climbing a rather rugged mountain, quite a rugged mountain intellectually, and maybe emotionally too. And I'm not asking you to agree with me at this point. I'm asking you if you can understand the line of my argument. Is that okay? Anybody who feel it isn't, they can have the mic and say why. You're all right. We're all together still. It's a bit like an expedition John Crook and people from our retreat made up Plinlimmon, you know. We always had someone at the end to make sure no one got lost. So, part two. The way out of social suffering. The two blessings. That's the first bit of this. The two blessings. And here I'd like to refer to an episode in my own life, two episodes, two rites of passage, the most significant in my own life, and one which I think some of the people here may have experienced. The first one was when I was a young man. You see how old I was. I think it was about 1947, about 17 or 18. And I received my first party card. You know what party that is. From a grizzled dockyard worker who still bore the scars of a fascist bullet which wounded him in the International Brigade at the Battle of the Ebro. Young romantic man, hugely inspiring. And the card, when you opened it, had a quotation from Lenin, enjoining me to vow to undertake the greatest project that a human being can with all my life and all my energy, the liberation of humankind. The liberation of humankind. But over the years, we did achieve some things. I'd certainly achieved some things as a dangerous agitator. Over the years, I begin to doubt. I said, look, all this is very well. There's one thing that's missing, a huge thing. What about what's going on inside people? What about that? What's going on there? Maybe that's something that we've missed out, why things are going wrong. So, being of a scientific mind, I had a look, tried some meditation, and was quite alarmed at what I saw. And eventually got involved in Buddhism, which seemed a very sophisticated form of inner inquiry. And so, several decades later, a sadder and wiser man, I once more took a vow to liberate all beings. But it was a different vow. It was when I took refuge, the refuges, from Genpo Roshi and received not a party card, but a black rakazu and a Dharma name. So I'd twice dedicated my life to liberating all beings. Now, this is quite interesting, really, isn't it? My problem was, and it deeply disturbed me. I couldn't rest because of it. How can I live my life with these two different aspirations? How can I? And I struggled with this for quite some time, and it caused me a good deal of grief. And I struggled to find a synthesis, a way of combining the dedication of my life to these two kinds of liberation as one liberation. Without a split, seamless and moving and convincing for me. And hopefully, I thought, well, when I've sorted out, other people might find this useful. It took quite a while and some insights, and working for 2 years on a book which attempted to explain this, called The Social Face of Buddhism. And the second edition is on sale over there. And it was well received, actually, and it was one of the contributions, only one, that really got social engaged Buddhism going. Now, these two rites of passage in my life encapsulate what Gary Snyder has called, I think, the two great blessings of human history. The two great blessings. The first blessing is the great emancipatory tradition in which I started my life. The movements for social justice, for a truly democratic commonwealth, for national and gender liberation, for peace, and latterly for ecological sustainability. The first manifestation of this great current, this tradition in humankind, was the English Revolution of the 1640s. What some were still called the good old cause, Its latest manifestation, no less remarkable, the Arab Spring. And its most perennial and important manifestation was what Jeremy Seabrook called socialism, the great sustaining myth over many decades of poor and ground down men and women throughout the world. And personally, I believe that that myth, so-called, is not dead. I can't see any other way forward, ultimately, except through some kind of market socialism. I won't go into that. Now, these emancipatory movements, this tradition has achieved much. It makes a much better world we live in than the Middle Ages, say. But ultimately, it has failed. Because, as we all, I think, agreed by now, that humankind is approaching the edge of an abyss. It seems quite likely. Though nothing is certain. And they failed because of ideology, because of social delusion, because of cumulative and collective individual fear. Existential fear. That of translated as hard ideology. If you think of the failure of socialism, this degeneration into communism. And on the other hand, if that didn't get it, and more latterly, the erosion, on the other hand, of the great soft ideology of consumerism. My wife comes from Belfast, and we were talking about this the other day, and I said, well, at least you've got a different kind of ideology now. We've just been down to Belfast, and we're amazed at all the new shopping malls and so on. So instead of these vicious ideologies leading to people being killed, they were now able to spend Saturdays instead in a shopping mall, which in the short term seems less lethal. But for many people throughout the world, is already extremely lethal and is now beginning to upset us all. Okay, so far. The other great tradition is the contemplative inner work tradition with which we are blessed by all the world's great religions. Christian contemplation, the Sufis, the Hasidic tradition, and so on. And of course, Buddhism, which I personally think is probably the most sophisticated and complex of all the inner work traditions. Although it's been made more effective by its borrowings from other traditions, social justice above all, the great blessing and offering to us of Christianity. But that weakness of received Buddhism is it never, for reasons that are understandable, we're going to hear, it never developed a social theory, and above all, it never developed a sense of social justice, something which has greatly interested academics. Social justice ripened by the humanism of the 18th century Enlightenment in Europe. More still, though there are several exceptions that prove the rule, on the whole, throughout its history, Buddhist organizations have remained subordinate to the powers that be. And as a vulnerable monastic-based religion, this was hardly avoidable. The ones that weren't monastically based, like Pure Land, had a better reputation in opposing some of the things that the powers that be imposed. What's more, Buddhism actually supported in several different ways the powers that be in a preaching a doctrine of social karmic retribution, whereby if you were born poor in the bottom of the pile, that would be because of nasty things your ancestors had done. A particularly vicious kind of social theory. Or more obviously, the disgraceful episode of Imperial Japanese Zen. Now, I believe we are now have, since we live in a world where these two traditions, these two cultures can be brought together, these two kinds of human emancipation, we have the opportunity, as I explained in my own personal history, to bring them together. Each needs the other. And what's more, the long accumulating fires of greed, aggression, and ignorance that threaten to consume us all make it urgently necessary to work to bring them together. And the recognition of that is one of the things that has caused us for this conference to be organized and for us to come together. An increasing and growing gatherings of this kind. It's hugely gratifying for those like David and I, who for many years worked almost alone in our particular vineyard with a few other staunch colleagues. Now, okay then, how to fuse the inner and outer work of human liberation? What do we do if that argument's convincing? What are we going to do? And let me say now that I greatly value the contribution of monastics to socially engaged Buddhism. You know, the quietest aspect, if you might say. I always remember in a York tea shop once with Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Anando. And he asked me, "We contemplatives, how can we help you guys in the streets? How can we help you?" And I said, "Well, by remaining staunch contemplatives." And we have some wonderful teaching on this theme from Thomas Merton and the likes of Ajahn Buddhadasa. However, I feel that in the West, an over-adherence to Buddhism's monastic tradition, in which sitting meditation is commonly, though not always, the central importance enjoined on us, poorly serves the practice of our development, our spiritual maturity in our own lives, and above all, in accomplishing this social revolution. It's not this important, I think. Meditation practice is invaluable in our personal practice. Nonetheless, there are two difficulties here. The first one is we all lead, as we all know here, everybody here knows, most of us lead more or less busy lives, with a lot of ups and downs and whatnot. And it's not possible for us, leading these lives, to do enough quasi-monastic sitting in the whole monastic tradition, because our retreats are traditionally like little monastic episodes. It's not possible for us to develop, most of us, to develop what I call a sufficient critical mass for this practice to transform our lives. The second argument, developed strongly by Charlotte Joko Beck and some other distinguished American teachers, is they argue the transferability of the kind of insights and sets of mind we can develop in sitting meditation, when it comes to transferring these to many real-life situations, is problematic. You sit, you have some insights, you come back from the retreat, and in no time, maybe, you're in a flaming argument with your boss or your partner. And your responses are a rather poor reflection on the kind of person you thought you'd become when you were on retreat. Jung referred to this very accurately as spiritual bypassing. A kind of situation where someone is clearly spiritually, appears to be spiritually very mature, has profound insights, maybe even develops the great enlightenment. But their own life is frankly absolute mess. And they don't seem to be able to do anything about it. Of course, there are extreme examples we all know about spiritual bypassing in the great scandals, which no need to say any more. There's meat and drink of so much Dharma gossip. So, what is developed, particularly in the States, is what's called everyday Buddhism. And everyday Buddhism, backed up by the clarity and tranquility of meditation, everyday Buddhism, the main thrust is about working skillfully with the discomfitures of the self in our everyday life. Particularly the discomfitures, they're the things that get us going and motivate us to do something about it. And in all the Buddhist traditions, to accept the discomfitures of your life, every kind of emotional and physical pain, is the way ultimately to develop spiritual maturity. And in developing that maturity, you learn to accept your human condition, which is difficult. It's the last thing we want to do, to accept all that pain. And accept is a lousy word here, but no one's thought of anything better. It's a kind of positive acceptance. Okay, and once you accept that, you are free from all that yearning and longing and struggling to be a strong self. Something else, something that's not me. You're free. And that freedom is a joy and clarity to start doing something, you know, as Blake preached, start doing something for the world, because you are at profoundly at ease. And that kind of practice has a whole raft of teachers, particularly in the States, developed is the practice of emotional awareness. And this is not the awareness of washing up the dishes mindfully, which, you know, and that's fine, it helps a little bit, but it isn't going to butter the parsnips, as it were. This kind of emotional awareness is a deep, visceral, body-rooted practice. It comes into action whenever the self is discomforted, and which is cultivated around the clock. It includes also an awakening to the stories the self tells about the self. And sometimes, if we're lucky, sitting in a little group, the stories that our friends tell about our self. And our belief in these stories is part of our problem. As David's pointed out in his splendid little book, The World is Made of Stories, which you just must buy if you haven't read it so far. Also, this kind of practice introduces an element of social interaction into the traditional retreats. A variety of kinds of social action pioneered by people like Norman Fisher, Al Mas, Gregory Kramer, and here in Britain by Vajragupta and many others. A sort of tradition of social action which was in fact pioneered by John Crook with his Western Chan retreats, and which is beginning to make some slow inroads into practice here. Not only in working in twos, but also working in small groups with a slow, meditative speaking stone, which brings up great compassion, deep listening. So the whole range of everyday Buddhism practice, which I've outlined, seems to me well suited to slowly dissolving the self-serving and delusive pull exerted by activism and service to others, let alone its value, which is what I'm primarily interested in teaching, in our personal lives. Because you can't separate these two things, of course. We don't have a social life and a personal life. Some people try to, but it doesn't work in the long run. And this practice of the inner work, as we call it, in socially engaged Buddhism, is the basic practice. So when I was asked recently to come to Dublin and teach on the weird theme of Buddhism and the Irish social crisis, economic crisis, a truly weird and challenging conjunction for many people who think Buddhism is about contemplative gnomes sitting in your garden. Quite a challenge. So, you know, I talked this kind of stuff the first day, and the next day we had a workshop day on Sunday morning in which the first thing we had a session in sitting meditation, but we also had a session in the practice of emotional awareness as foundations for the intention there to get some kind of engaged Buddhist network going over in Dublin. So this kind of practice is the underlying foundation for what I call creating bit by bit a radical culture of awakening. It's radical because deep into each person's soul. It's radical because it's directed to radical root changes out there. And as I see it, it will evolve as a way of life for millions of people, just like millions of people, and certainly the forward-looking middle classes, but hopefully beyond that, having a good diet, keeping your body in trim with appropriate exercise, all that kind of thing, is now part of many people, certainly here, part of pretty well everybody's life, I would say. And it's slowly spreading. And I would see, and we have the beginnings of this, whereby doing your morning sit, your morning contemplation, is again accepted as, you know, how you live your life, and more than just a fad. I was delighted to find with my Guardian a few months ago, one of these little pull-out guides, about how to meditate. It's brilliant. Not just Buddhist meditation, all kinds of contemplative meditation. You know, there's the Guardian advising, it's truly the most likely people to take this up, you know, to just become part of their fashionable life. And when we have a critical mass of men and women beginning to cultivate themselves in this way, we begin to create a shift, which I've called a radical culture of awakening. And we've already got the beginnings of this. It floats quite well on what the Americans are now beginning to call the mindfulness revolution. The mindfulness revolution, which now involves hundreds of thousands of Americans in all walks of life and kinds of organization, and is beginning to have quite an impact, as many of you know, over here. I think it's a very valuable development, though I have reservations to do with its lack of a strong ethical dimension. It's much favored in the US Marine Corps, which is enough to say about that. And its relative shallowness for many people. It can become a middle class fad. But nonetheless, it provides a sort of flood on which we can float this more profound thing, which I call a radical culture of awakening. And eventually, I would hope to see emerging a growing number of men and women who have a sustainable culture, a sustainable cycle. And it's sustainable because they are sufficiently at ease with themselves, not to be drawn into ideologies, both the soft one we're involved in at present and the older, harder ones, which have destroyed the great emancipatory movements which alone can save our planet. They burn with a bright flame without the smokiness of self-neediness, which fucks everything up on a personal and public level. And there are more of these people around than you might think. Everywhere I've worked in my long life, in every department, office, group, or whatever, there's always been one or two people. Usually not Buddhist or anything in particular, just born that way, perhaps, who burnt with a bright flame. There were people I could go to about some really complex and difficult and controversial job, problem in the organization. You sit down with them, and you could talk about it. Their ego didn't get in their way, so it was great. You know, we could really work together. And I prefer to work with them than to work on an easy problem with someone whose ego needs fouled up the conversation. For a start, I had to go through all the stuff of getting them at ease and so on and pandering a bit to their ego needs before we get down to doing anything. Well, I think many have had that experience, haven't you? Yeah? Plenty of people like that around, more than you think. Always one or two everywhere I've worked. Great people. And they weren't necessarily Buddhists. Most of them weren't. I guess they were just born that way. But there are a lot of them around, more than you might think. So, it's not all that far-fetched, I don't think, in my experience anyway, to talk about this evolving culture of radical awakening. There are more people there than we may at first sight suspect. One way of moving things on is through a kind of affinity group, and we started this already in the Network of Engaged Buddhists, a kind of affinity group which originated in the States. They call them base groups there. And what this group is like is this. It has, as its members, not just sort of card-carrying Buddhists, but anybody else who wants to come along, who's interested in inner work, who's felt the need, as well as all the things you do outside, to look within and see really what's going on. A surprising number of people without any religious affiliation who are interested in this, actually, as we all know, who've rejected former religion, but are deeply interested in what they see as spirituality. And it would consist also, therefore, of humanists and inner work contemplatives of any stripe who want to come along. The group would meet periodically, maybe monthly, and they would share their experiences of how they undertake this inner work in terms of the outer work they have to do. It might be the outer work they have to do in terms of where their employment is. But more particularly, I'm thinking of the outer work they do in terms of trying to do a bit of good in society. Where they're social activists, Samaritans, prison chaplains, or whatever. They share their stuff together. The endeavor to support one another and to inform one another. And in the American pattern, from time to time, they invite the visit of one or more mentors who've specialized in this, perhaps more than they have. It helps them to resolve some knotty problems they've got tangled up in. In this country, the Network of Engaged Buddhists has already established one of these, what we call in the UK, amity groups. And it's meeting this weekend at in London in the Finsbury Park area. We also have plans, and the ground is very promising for it, to start similar groups in Brighton and in Birmingham. And I'm pretty sure we will get on with that. And my vision is a whole network of these groups throughout the country as the beginnings of what I call the psycho-spiritual social revolution. And there's the possibility then of another one, is there not? Dare I say it? In Bristol. And if you'd like to see me, or Matrasara, where are you, Matrasara? Would you mind standing up so people can recognize you? Thank you. So see me on Matrasara. And if you'd like to join us, incidentally, in the network, again, see Matrasara, and we'll sign you up. It's a very nice kind of group. Somehow we don't get riven by all the things that many groups do. We all remain bloody good friends and have a terrific time together, despite the fact we often... Well, Matrasara's particularly has been out and had some rather difficult experiences with the forces of law and order. Climate camp and things like that. But wonderful new world, and well, it's important in our lives. But that's the commercial plug aside. And I hope there will be some people who would like to have a go at this in Bristol, because Bristol is one of those cities, like Brighton in a rather different way, which I think is quite ripe, this kind of thing, and can enlarge one's practice. Okay, so far. All right. I expect more controversy, for God's sake. Right. The other thing of many possible practices, what I call inner agendas. I don't know whether it's happened to you, but the Spaniards say, God save me from my friends, from my enemies I can save myself. And it's clearly what they're referring to is the difficulty of working with colleagues and comrades in a group which has a kind of project which is quite demanding and which brings up all the ego stuff. And I think you've all probably had the experience of sitting around a table, the agenda is on the table, what we're going to do out there, but you've sat with the blighters long enough to know what each personal agenda is. You know, to be liked and belonged by the group, to make my mark in the group, and so on and so on and so on. And the idea is that before the group gets down to dealing with the outer agenda, sufficient trust has been built up to go around the table and share each person's inner agenda. Quite a certain amount of trust and courage. But once that's been done, it's easier to deal with the outer agenda. And the failure to do this has led to a number of radical groups. I'm thinking of one I know of, a transition town group, that just collapsed, not for any external pressures, because there's too much ego need in it. You know, too many people wanted to have their view accepted and were not willing to compromise, because if they did, it would increase their sense of existential anxiety, if you like, and inadequacy. Just collapsed. So I think that is another kind of valuable practice. And then, of course, there are a whole lot of resources. I think it was Jan who yesterday referred to Donald Rothberg's superb book, The Engaged Spiritual Life. Wonderful book, which gets you started and is full of interesting exercises you can try out in your own life. And there are a number of long-established teachers, above all, Joanna Macy, who in her books and trainings and retreats has contributed strongly to socially engaged Buddhism. And now there are a whole number of increasingly experienced trainers, of which Matrasara has particularly distinguished herself, but as a trainer for Network of Engaged Buddhists and her own Sangha, Tri Ratna and beyond, who are beginning to work. And in fact, Matrasara and David and I had a lunch with some other comrades here, and we talked about possibility of developing a retreat for Buddhist teachers who were interested in going further into teaching engaged Buddhism and delicately and sensitively linking this with the foundation teachings with which they were more familiar. So there are plenty of resources to help you get going. And there are also quite a lot of shoulders to which you can, quite a lot of wheels to which you can put your shoulders. What I call Dharma compatible wheels, where the water is not too deep and a current is not too strong, ranging from the New Economics Foundation, a left-wing think tank for which I've got a lot of time and has an interesting well-being group which I've been in touch with and which is on all fours with where we Buddhists are at. And the Green Party, which for quite some time had a kind of spiritual network. I think it's disappeared now, but it is enough to revive. Another place to work, umpteen compatible and congenial places in which to do your outer work. And if you're really bold and feel you're up to it, you could try a political party where the water is extremely turbulent and where the incautious can be swept off their feet. It may take them some time to realize how far they've been swept off their feet. My friend Joyce Edmund Smith in Brighton, city councillor, did one such work. And every time I walk her through the town, she's able to point out all her achievements. But it was hard work in terms of the inner work as well as the outer work. Yeah. Now, actually, that vow I talked about at the beginning, there was something missing from it. The vow to save beings innumerable. Innumerable. Which is crazy, of course. To save all beings, which makes that into a koan. And you might say, okay, what this guy's preaching is equally impracticable. Maybe that's why we need to reflect on this vow to save all beings, because in that koan lies the answer to the argument, this is impractical, this is hardly worth committing yourself to. It's quite mad. It's a brilliant idea, brilliant formulation, but I mean, how can it suck seed? And Christopher Titmus had a wonderful term here. He referred to the enfeebling fetishism of results. Fetishism of results. Because the self wants results. You get involved in an organization, whether it's a Buddhist meditation group, or whether it's joining this, that, or the other group, and you expect results. You pay your money, you put in your time, you put your energy, and the self has mixed motives. But it wants to achieve something so it feels good. Nothing more we want to be good and right. That's what the self craves, righteousness. We want results. But it's been pointed out by the great spiritual teacher, T.S. Eliot, said, not hope, because hope would be of the wrong kind. As another Christian activist said, not hope, but there are possibilities. Something that moves us beyond conventional optimism, and that which moves us beyond optimism is simply need. There is a need to do this. There is a need for this kind of compassion in the world. And so, we do it. Quite simple. It's a bit like the analogy with our positive acceptance frees us. And that's just a need. We do it beyond optimism. All right. It's just a little poem, not mine, to finish with. It's from Mike Jenkins, poet of coal mining, Merthyr Tydfil, which has suffered more than anywhere in the UK from corporate greed. And I saw this the other day in our local gallery, where his friend's pictures of Merthyr and his own bits of poetry. The one that caught my eye was this. I am the no-hope canary. You know, the canary in a coal mine that signals it. I am the no-hope canary, singing in the deepest gallery. Below the vaults of borrowed money. Thank you. If you'd fancy following some of these things up, in the lunch hour, with a cup of tea in one hand and a baguette in the other, you might like to meet up with David and Maitre Sara and me over in that corner for a little chat, a kind of informal seminar. Now, I think we've got 10 minutes, haven't we? Yeah. So, time for questions, and what I would ask you is particularly to focus on your understanding of my sermon. Your disagreements are fine, they may have to do with understanding, but keep it that way. It might be more helpful. Okay, so any questions?